ladies and gentlemen, if you have any difficulty hearing me, don't hesitate to ask me to speak up. It's easy enough to get people to defend Good. I have in mind, in my defense, Baudelaire's remark a long time ago that the devil's cleverest wile is to convince the modern world that he doesn't exist. And for that reason, we have to be reminded that perhaps indeed he does. Hence the necessity of defending evil as evil. Southern literature, like the South itself, is such a various creature that one is ill-advised to pronounce dogmatically upon it. So that is a temptation difficult to resist, caught up as we have been by that impressive flowering of letters in this century known as the Southern Renaissance. At risk of some presumption, then, I should like to limit our attention to a particular kind of Southern literature, or rather to a particular kind of Southern writer who may be distinguished from a variety of his brothers in and out of the South. I feel a special affinity myself to this writer, and for that reason let me here give warning that my testimony is partisan, though I believe it will support sound generalization. The writer I want to single out from his fellows is, however, an elusive preacher, sometimes even to himself, self-knowledge being the treacherous gnosis it is. Besides which, our writer is not likely to produce his art from a position he has established firmly by dogma or ideology, though he may come to such a pass by the long labor of his art. He is more likely intent upon looking at his immediate world with wonder and curiosity. He takes a delight in his immediate neighbor's multitudinous engagements of that world, both for his neighbor's sake and for his art's sake. That is, he grows from within that world rather than choosing to stand outside it as separate from or superior to it. Certainly, he does not suppose himself its creator when he is pleased by its reflection in the world he makes with words. One of his habits is that though he may wander from his neighborhood, he is apt to return and settle down in it. That is, he does not long believe that in order to make artful use of his world, he must live in New York City or on the continent. He does not feel driven, as James Joyce's young artist Stephen does, into silence, exile, and cunning. Another sign of his peculiarity may be that he survives in his native or even adopted land in part through his sense of humor, without which he might well be left with only the resources of wit and irony to reach an accommodation with the mystery of existence. For wit and irony, unmoderated by some humor, become modes of dissociation from existence. The point is difficult to refine briefly. This is what frightened me, Madison. I've got so many pages to refine it, you see. It's difficult to refine briefly, but I'm attempting to point to a humor in the writer himself which reflects his acceptance of the limits of his own power to shape or create existence, an acceptance of his own humanity, which is more difficult to the writer sometimes, perhaps, because he so easily confuses himself as maker of a world with God, the maker of the world. Compare the general attitude of two great writers toward the country and countrymen who feed their fiction, Joyce, whom I've mentioned, and William Faulkner. There are many likenesses between them, particularly the strong attraction they share to the immediate and local, to a history that is in their blood and memory, and at every point adjacent to their senses in an immediate way. Still, I at least sense in Joyce's fiction a feeling of some discomfort with the ordinary Dubliner, almost at times an embarrassment in his presence, which seems to require the poet's distancing himself through irony and wit, but not for his art's sake alone. Not just Stephen Dedalus, but Joyce himself must fight against sounding like that agonizing Quentin Compson at Harvard who insists at the top of his voice that he doesn't hate the South. I'm suggesting that the distance between Faulkner and his Quentin is more marked than that between Joyce and his Stephen. In Faulkner, one senses an amused acceptance of the ordinary Mississippian, an openness to foibles of the simple, an attitude that sometimes rises to lyrical heights or becomes entangled in a comedy of the ridiculous, given an almost epic sweep, as in Spotted Horses. Incidentally, I'm not suggesting that our Southern writer inevitably creates masterpieces, that such a fellow, by his loving acceptance of limitations, the humility that evidences itself often as humor, is the superior of Joyce. In fact, irony and wit may afford such control of one's art that the writer protects himself against that excess of sentiment which so easily turns into sentimentality. The fear that sentiment may turn treacherous to his art seems to me to haunt Joyce, but I think one must search hard to find instances of just plain bad writing in the body of his work. The task is a lot easier in Faulkner if one sets himself such tasks. Our Southern writer is not always the consummate craftsman, though he often is. For craft has to do finally and more immediately with the mystery of a writer's particular gifts and with his industry in the service of those limited gifts. We must not confuse our writer with a Southerner who may be said to write about the South any more than we would confuse any writer using Irish material with a Joyce or a Yeats. We certainly don't want to confuse him with those who intend to please a tourist curiosity, those who cater to an amorphous, deracinated audience whose number in this world, alas, is legion. Whether they be titillated by Tualura Lura or way down upon the Suwannee River, Frank Yerby or Margaret Mitchell may serve as example here of a writer who cultivates an audience's residual interest in the historical, our vague nostalgia for origins, which so easily atrophies into an appetite for the fanciful and sentimental, the last sad state into which our ontological hunger may fall. Our writer, to the contrary, is intense in his concern for concrete reality, as it may give body to his art, incorporate his word world, but that interest includes his concern for the hard complexities of history. He knows that our history, anchored in place, has both a threatening and a loving immediacy which our indulgent fancy violates at hazard to artist or audience. That is, he knows, in words I adapt from T.S. Eliot, that a people without history is not redeemed from time, for history is a pattern of timeless moments, and they bear inexorably upon this very moment, in this very place. And that's why, of course, it's ridiculous to object, Ken, that because the force overcame, we therefore are not interested in what was overcome by force. It's still with us. These moments may not be denied without fatal distortions of the present, which, in a favorite Faulknerian word, bequeath deformations of reality to the future. A sort of congenital spiritual distortion of community, if I may be allowed a metaphysical trope. Our writer, we're saying, has a strong sense of place and person in a relationship which is nucleus to the growing body of a community in time. Community always bears deep down both the past and the future. He does not suppose that the particulars of either setting or character in his fiction are created ex nihilo by the artist, though he may and should enjoy those special freedoms Aristotle distinguishes in art as opposed to history, the freedoms of the possible or probable. He knows through his very breathing that in the world he inhabits as man, the seasons of being are affected at a depth more profound than any empirical measure of time or place allow. Thus, although he is likely to focus upon a single house and family, a small town, a county, he does so not to lament social poverty or psychological isolation, as temporal users of the world might be content to do, but to reveal a largeness hidden in the limited. Nor does he use the local, his southern, to dramatize what turns out to be only a private, isolated version of the fabulous self lost among the accidental stars. That sort of writer may write of any place or no place, since place is neither congenial to nor particularly relevant to his concern. He is a displaced person by preference. If he were to put the point, he might preach it as Hayes Mates does in Flannery O'Connor's Wise Blood. Here is Hayes on the subject. I preach there are all kinds of truth, your truth and somebody else's, but behind all of them there's only one truth, and that is that there's no truth. Where you come from is gone, where you thought you were going to never was there, and where you are is no good unless you can get away from it. Where is there a place for you to be? No place. Nothing outside you can give you any place. The placeless writer, of course Hayes gets his comeuppance in the course of his action. The placeless writer may use the same material world as a Flannery O'Connor, but it will not be used in the same way, for what Miss O'Connor sees and what our Mates-like writer sees are quite different, though they look at the same object so far as we can tell. Our writer does not see himself as merely the creator of a textual world, and Hayes wants to stay inside his mind too, a cage of words such as Hayes's, which he builds to serve as an arena for the annex of that aberrant modern God, the self, which has lost its belief in any reality separate from its own marooned awareness. If he does not believe that his own consciousness occupies such a closed world, neither will he see art as so divorced from his fellows that each lonely mind is forever trapped within its symbolic posturings, its symbols having no extrinsic reference, and its order internally willed but irrelevant to any meaning, even to the trapped self. You remember Milton, I'm defending the devil, remember what he says, Milton has him say, the mind is its own place. It's the only place. Hayes Mates is in that tradition. And this, incidentally, is a fad, it seems to me, the current fad, not only in our social institutions, but in much of our criticism and philosophy and art. Our writer sees it for what it is, a fad perhaps not unrelated to such mass isolationism as disco dancing. But in a positive, older, and intellectually more viable way, our Southern writer is mimetic. He believes that art, however else it may differ from the other modes of the mind's hymns to existence, the modes of science or philosophy or theology, also bears an appreciable relation to reality beyond itself. His position on art and its ends is a corollary to his belief that the individual self has real and not illusional relations with other selves in communities wherever two or three are gathered together. That is, he believes we are bound in a mystery larger than his mastery of art, without which binding, one's art or science or philosophy becomes only a form of magic. Such a binding is larger and more inclusive than any particular calling to us within the world, to be a doctor, a lawyer, a writer. And our writer will very likely begin to suspect that we are bound not only in time, but beyond time, in a calling which speaks to him through the one given which underlies all the structures of his awareness, all the symbols through which he may attempt to touch reality. That one given is, of course, existence itself. That larger binding, he at least senses, is within an ordering of all being which should satisfy our desire for beginning and end even when we cannot find it satisfying. Without the limits of beginning and end, particularity itself ceases to have any meaning. Those are deep hungers in us for a completeness of the self beyond what the self can imagine for itself. Hungers buried essentially in the soul. for ontology and teleology, and Professor Bradford was talking about this yesterday, as I recall, ontology and teleology are not merely technical names of categories of thought created by the rational mind for its entertainment, though often so used. If the philosopher, scientist, theologian wrestles in his several ways with these seemingly abstract terms, our writer attempts as poet to incarnate a reality that feeds the hunger, to give local habitation and a name to our desire, whether he present his hero as struggling to return to some Ithaca, or as a pilgrim with momentary vision of a multifoliate rose embraced by an inexpressible light beyond all our purgatorial struggles with dark and light, or a possessed creature trying to subdue 100 square miles of Mississippi wilderness to his own bent desire. The end we reach toward may be a false one. Our struggles for origins within the middleness of reality may be quite misguided, but our beginnings within that complexity stirs a valid desire for larger ends. Caught in the muddling middle, and I'm playing, of course, with a term that many people have already mentioned at this conference, one that Voegelin calls especially to our attention, the in-betweenness, you see, which goes back even beyond Plato to Homo, I'm suggesting. Caught in the muddling middle, we began where all drama of the spirit must begin, in that middle. As Flannery O'Connor says of us, recognizing our shared experience of this confusing in-betweenness that threatens us, there is something in us as storytellers and as listeners to stories that demands that what falls at least be offered the chance to be restored. For our writer, man's being, man's self, cannot be an absolute agent without originating cause or proper end, not an accident of accidents, and thus always and only the meaningless victim of meaningless middle. For he senses or believes or knows that even accidental existence must happen within some inclusive reference if the concept of the accidental is to have any meaning at all. And he cannot believe that his own mind is a sufficient inclusive reference. For him, the hunger for a chance to be restored will become foil in his drama of fallen man's several dreams of progress, spawned by Gnostic presumptions against being that are as ancient as that first fall in the garden. The old presumptions of the self as dominant power in this infinite, swampy middle. Thus, pride or hubris, however low and common or high and royal his agents may be, become the high themes of his storytelling. Now, the modern reader hungers for the redemptive act, in spite of his being inhabitant of a world which tries to deny redemption, except as it may be used metaphorically to describe some psychological or sociological recovery that implies man the ultimate god of the meaningless middle. And I contend that such a hunger is a sign of the possibility of his return to health. One hungers because there's such a creature as food, St. Thomas tells us. One is ill because there's such a state as health. One founders or fails or falls only as measured against some high calling to a graceful dance. Such modern hunger speaks ancient origin. But as Miss O'Connor adds in the passage just quoted, our writer's audience has largely forgotten the costs of restoration, for our sense of evil is diluted or lacking altogether. From her own position, the cost of evil to the individual is an absolute beyond all worldly inflations, all relative scales, being the absolute loss of the self. Her Tarwater in The Violent Buried Away discovers that the cost exceeds the self's solvency. He is consumed almost to extinction, but also discovers some restoration in the terror of an absolute mercy, which beyond all reason buys him out of self-centered bankruptcy. Our Southern writer may not, of course, be as resolutely convinced by faith and reason of a transcendent God. Flannery O'Connor is, Faulkner, it seems to me, is not. But it is in the light of such argument as she makes, I think, that one begins to recognize the considerable difference between the visions radiated by the God-haunted writer, like Faulkner, and those versions of existence made by man-haunted writers like Flaubert and James and Hemingway and Fitzgerald. It seems to me we have a stream going back. Or nearer home, the difference between becomes conspicuous between Flannery O'Connor, Andrew Lytle, Madison Jones as Southern writers, as diverse as they are, and Carson McCullers, Shirley Ann Grau, and Truman Capote as Southern writers. To borrow from our writer's Eastern cousin, Nathaniel Hawthorne, we may say that our writer is reluctant to stray too far from the town pump or from the well on the old family place, and precisely because, despite the reflections of the local in such waters, he knows they are deeper than time and more healing than any words the self may speak of and to itself alone. Still, this inclination to the local is easily misunderstood by those who would believe the home place well polluted by provincialism. As I've already hinted, there is misunderstanding not only by the postmodernist anarchist mind that would drink of any muddy puddle and smack in delight to outrage the supposedly innocent among us, denying the existence of thirst even as he does so. Miss O'Connor's story, Good Country People, speaks nicely to this, where Holger, the PhD in existentialism, encounters the Bible salesman who was born believing in nothing. You don't have to get your doctorate to reach that state. In another direction, our Southern writer is misunderstood by that post-naturalist mind, which is so heavily at home in the academy, particularly by those who see literature as a sector of our intellectual estate to be seized by the pseudosciences of sociology and psychology and turned to social and political ends. The anarchist of whom we first spoke sees mimesis as an illusion. For him, in Gerald Graff's words in a recent book that I commend to you, though I would suggest it be read with caution, Literature Against Itself, for him, in Graff's words, there is, quote, no such thing as a real object outside language, no nature or real life outside the literary text, no real text beyond the critical interpretation, and no real persons or institutions behind the multiplicity of messages human beings produce. Everything is swallowed up in an infinite regress of textuality, thus Graff. These are primarily attacking the New Bloomsburys, as I'm fond of calling them, whose center at Yale, Professor Brooks and I have talked about this group, I think. But the socio-psychologist, and in Chaucer's phrase applied to his doctor and apothecary, each makes the other for to win, the socio-psychologist rather takes our writer's work as a local naturalism which may be made to yield evidence suited to his own Gnostic ideology. Yet his denial of nature or life is only partial in contrast to the anarchist structuralists. He must admit the existence of some reality, the social world for the sociologist, the psychic world for the psychologist at least. Still, he sees it existing for the purpose of being shaped, being restructured to suit some primary human dream. It is no accident that sociology and psychology have become dominant forces in the civil state since World War II, subordinating even Harvard economics to janitorial status in the halls of Congress and in the White House. Well, since the days of Auguste Comte, the state has been gradually transformed into the Gnostic son of the world, the substitute Emmanuel, and the Holy Spirit of social humanity has been increasingly called into a presence as Lord and giver of life to individual man, filling the embarrassing gap between human knowledge and human power in the ideological struggles to subjugate existence to human will. A humanistic priesthood has emerged through which one is required to worship an abstraction, humanity, as the official state religion under the threat of exile for both heresy and treason. Its principal establishment is that college of priests called HEW, pronounced Hugh, as you know, and its energy and our substance are spent largely in hewing individual persons to fit its vague dream of the ideal citizen. We must observe carefully, then, how our Southern writer differs in his address to reality, not only from the anarchist mind, but from that Gnostic director of social and psychic being also. No matter how particular nor how local his material, however deeply colored by literal social and psychological aspects of man's being, he is not so much acting as reporter or statistician of particularity as he is bearing witness to depths in reality beyond all facts or photographs. For he knows, again to summon Flannery O'Connor, that a view taken in the light of the absolute will include a good deal more than one taken merely in the light provided by a house-to-house survey. One is not likely at this late date, despite those large forces that distort reality, to miss this point in Faulkner's postage stamp county, unless one's intellect and sensibilities have been fatally atrophied. To cite once more Miss O'Connor as an articulate spokesman for this writer I'm trying to define, the longer you look at an object, the more of the world you see in it. And it's well to remember that the serious fiction writer always writes about the whole world, no matter how limited his particular scene. That is why the dedicated, unblinking naturalist will always write more largely than the academic's definition of naturalism will allow, assuming of him a talent and industry in support of his courage in the presence of creation. To misunderstand this point, as many critics have done in attempting to come to terms with the complexity of the Southern Renaissance, is to see this Southern phenomenon only at its social and psychological level, the point at which our Southern writer himself begins. That is why I keep underlining my theme. For our writer, the slant of the sun upon a particular person in a particular place is more deeply significant of the large mystery of creation than is allowed by any conception of existence as a continuous accident or a dead mechanism with which man is forced to struggle for an order of his own devising. He sees both the postmodernist anarchist and the Gnostic disciple of old Enlightenment ideas attempting to reorder creation under their banner of progress when he is seeking the dance. I keep coming back to that. Mel Bradford brought it up yesterday. I'm very fond of recalling Chesterton's remark in his little book on Chaucer, that up to a certain point in our development, we conceive of life as a dance, after which, and he means after the age of Chaucer, it becomes a race. And that seems to be a theme that several of us keep touching upon. Both the Gnostic manipulator and the anarchist both operate out of the same false grounds. For both of them, the in-between they wish to manage is an accident which has inexplicably thrown them up. But our writer sees both being itself and the conditions of being as a given in some sense. And the given implies a giver, however confounding the approach to the agency of that gift. Therefore, our writer, by his art, inevitably opposes those violations of the world that proceed from any premise of existence as either random chaos or ordered but spiritless mechanism. A reading of his work at what criticism is called the naturalistic level, as a ground for exercising social or psychic manipulations of complex existence, will overlook the spiritual dimension of that work, particularly its reverence of person, place, and thing. For our writer, whether he presents us a version of community on so small a scale as one of Miss O'Connor's decimated families, or so large as Faulkner's rich county, reflects the community as a spiritual organism, though fallen from fullness. Nor need one be the Thomist Miss O'Connor is to realize that in man's limited estate, he necessarily approaches the spiritual in the concrete, created world that is always just at hand. To touch that world is already to reach toward its cause. even if one realized that act as a spiritual one only feebly or not at all. The Gnostic manipulator is himself subject to such a shock of recognition as occasional conversions suggest. Man has believed for a very long time that the first intellectual step along the spiritual road is made within the country of naturalism through one's body. It is a step made within a context of our sensual response to some reality separate from the self. The belief is in Homer and Aristotle, in Dante and St. Thomas. I must get on, because I want to talk more about evil. Here's a good place to pick up. Our writer, I'm saying, in words I adapt from Stark Young's contribution to I'll Take My Stand, feels himself called to witness certain principles intrinsic to creation, not because those principles belong to him, but because he belongs to those principles. And that's a significant difference between the Gnostic, I think, and our writer. To put the point as Alan Tate might do, he is a spiritual regionalist, not an intellectual provincial, that secular Gnostic of whom Eric Voegelin has written so revealingly. In Voegelin's term, which we've repeatedly used, our writer finds himself deeply engaged in the in-between, the only source for the material of his made world, but with an openness of mind and spirit toward the complication of existence, in consequence of which he finds himself inevitably anti-Gnostic. Thus he celebrates the rich complexity of existence, although to celebrate that complexity does not mean to present it with an artificial sweetness and light. We may see this point everywhere in William Faulkner. In Absalom, Absalom, Sutpen attempts to limit existence to an arena of 100 square miles by sheer dominance over the land and the creatures bounded by that artificial measure of nature. His attempt to manipulate man and nature is tragically shattered. And in Go Down Moses, Ike McCaslin attempts to reject any binding by place or history, abandoning his inherited land and sacrificing persons dear to him beyond his romantic imaginings, as he comes at last to realize. For Faulkner distinguishes between the responsibility of a man's stewardship within the grounds of being and man's old temptation to control being itself. Christian orthodoxy sees this temptation in the light of the fall in the garden and speaks of original sin. There's a very complex dramatization of this distinction in Go Down Moses, which I may only touch upon here to make my point a little clearer, perhaps, though the rich texture of Ike's place in nature and history warrants a long devotion. In those stories, we witness two Gnostic forces in conflict. There is the obvious active destruction by the invading timber companies that ravage the big woods. But it is an encroachment upon a world Ike McCaslin has already abandoned through the illusion of his sacrificial act. Ike may be described perhaps as a passive Gnostic. In an ultimately destructive way, he abandons his responsibility as steward of place in time. Caught between these two forces, trying to rediscover and redefine man's ordinate responsibility in nature, is McCaslin Edmonds, who must even bear Ike's name more heavily in consequence of Ike's refusal. For he is an Edmonds and not so directly descended as Ike. Ike supposes that by relinquishing his title to old Carruthers McCaslin's land, he may separate himself from tainted history by repudiating it, and in some degree anneal, as he says, the wrongs of his forefathers. He intends a sacrificial act, but he presumes to rescue the world he inherits, to redeem time, as it were, as if he could command grace. As he comes to realize at last in the story Delta Autumn, man may be a waster of the world through the ravenous appetite so general in community, but he may also mistake himself as sufficient agent of grace, whether grace will or no. That is, Ike presumes a role which Orthodox tradition allows only to Christ. It makes him heroic, finally. One learns by failure. That's the difference between the hero and the anti-hero. If we call this kind of Southern writing mimetic We acknowledge that its limits are determined by the order of creation. Its limits must also be distinguished from those of science or philosophy or theology. The possible or probable are displayed as dramatic speculation upon the complexity of existence in a way quite separate from those explorations made by a biochemist or historian or metaphysician, as the artist slowly learns and sometimes not at all. He may nevertheless present our nature in such a way that it becomes increasingly difficult for the sensitive mind to deny a spiritual dimension to reality, most particularly that spiritual dimension in man that is man's by virtue of the elemental gift of his existence. For it is out of this gift that scientist or philosopher or historian or poet fashions his responses to creation. Whether one clear and plant a few acres or exercise civil authority in Washington, D.C., the gesture towards order and growth is inevitably a gesture beyond the self, however willful or blind one is to the root cause of such gesture. It is the gift of being that makes gesture possible, and it is within this gift that we are inexorably bound one to another. And from that point, I talked a little bit about Solzhenitsyn as Southerner here. I'm going to skip that and go quickly to another concern, to Richard Weaver, since Ken has picked him up here. Particularly to the ideas have consequences. And we ought to remember that Weaver can write this book, I think, largely because he's already done that work that is finally published posthumously as The Southern Tradition at Bay. The range is larger in Ideas Have Consequences, but it's there already. The intrusion of Occam's nominalism into a larger realism, which held creation in relation to its transcendent cause, Weaver argues, is an intrusion whose consequences divide man against himself. Early on in Ideas Have Consequences, we read, sentimentality, with its emotion lavished upon the trivial and the absurd, brutality, which can make no distinctions in the application of violence. Those who base their lives on the unintelligence of sentimentality fight to save themselves from the unintelligence of brutality. Thus, our senseless affections and hatreds, rising out of the unintelligence of sentimentality, lead to the large destructions of recent history with which we are so much familiar, effects out of our struggle for self-justification. In our time, that is, from the time of Adolf Eichmann and Auschwitz down to the Reverend Jim Jones of Jonestown, the Gnostic's detachment from being seems increasingly to assault our residual sensibilities in terrible tableau. It disturbs us particularly when the effects reach a level of sensational action whose spectacle no longer allows our inattention. Even time will celebrate it, you see. The horror at Auschwitz or Jonestown seems a personal assault because we have forgotten the evil that is potential in each man's power over nature, but are reminded by events beyond our understanding that we are nevertheless members one of another, even in such dark displays of community as mass murder. The Gnostic manipulators of being, the directors of the reconstructions of reality to fit millennial dreams, find it expedient to obscure that potential evil common to all men. You see why I'm defending evil, I hope. For in order to distill power from the ferment of the popular spirit of the age, it is important that they not disturb that volatile source. Otherwise, the reductions of being, you see, we have to all be good if we're going to be used to an end. If we think ourselves not good, we are less easily used. Not only must the dreamed end be persuasively presented as a common good, but the source of that power, the individual, to be directed to the good end, must be assumed uncontaminated, lest the hint of spiritual pollution at the source of power affect the consent of our will that the power be used to construct the dream. You see, even the Gnostic recognizes that we are more decent than not. And if you think that you might be wrong, you're going to be hesitant to do the wrong thing. Little wonder, then, that original sin in that source, individual men, as either metaphorical or literal, must be removed from our reflection as a species of Neanderthal theology. But when an Eichmann or a Jones at last stands before us as agent of murder on a statistically grand scale, and we're impressed by statistics, you see, we are astounded by the seeming disparity between the destruction and the insignificant, obscure agent. Our easy dreams become disturbed, and the popular spirit stirs in a threatening way. The death penalty even might be reinstituted. We are shocked, I suggest, because we have been willingly led to forget the complexity of human nature spoken to by the concept of original sin, a doctrine many Southern writers are loath to abandon. For if the hero need not be an Oedipus or a Count Roland or King Richard I, neither must the villain be so conspicuous a figure on the stage of our awareness as Iago or Count Ganelon, a point Faulkner makes with disturbing effect through his unfolding of Flem Snopes and Popeye. We tend to come to terms with a Sutphen or with a Stalin or Hitler. That is, we think we understand. Our anger and bafflement are assuaged as our understanding is flattered by submerged Hegelian thought. These agents are instances of a coincidence of power in dynamic, if terrifying, figures when seen in the reduction of reality into the myth of our age, historicism. Through such figures move the great contending forces of the age. They become archetypal, like Attila the Hun, a Robespierre, or Napoleon. Their great acts of destruction underline climaxes in the flux of history. Seeming to give history a godlike direction on that race in the flow of time when measured by our post-Hegelian mind. But then comes some functionary, such as Eichmann, a high school dropout, the failed son of a tram company accountant, who becomes an efficiency expert in transporting millions beyond time in a final solution. He becomes an absolutist of ordered fact beyond his father's fondest dreams. And what of such a peripheral figure as the Reverend Jim Jones, who scatters the random leaves of our progressivist social world on a jungle floor to be displayed in unliving color on the cover of Time magazine? What of such an inconspicuous West Virginia child as that small boy buying candy at the corner store, who suddenly blooms darkly in our evening papers out of California under the name of Charles Manson? Anonymous hidden evil breaks out, rises to the level of a name no longer inconspicuous, for the name itself gains a magnitude by the enormity of effect wrought by the obscure agent of history bearing that name. Adolf Eichmann is to be forever a substitute for the millions of nameless, common, and uncommon people he helped destroy in the name of an apocalyptic final solution. Hannah Arendt, having attended the Eichmann trial in Jerusalem, is arrested by a new idea, the banality of evil. The apparent contradiction between her new concept of evil and what she calls our, quote, tradition of thought, which sees evil as something demonic, led her to a two-volume reconsideration of the problem, The Life of the Mind, in which she examines the nature of thinking, willing, judging. Whether she would have held to her new concept is problematic, since she did not live to complete the section of the work on judging. But in setting out, she says of Eichmann these interesting things. I was struck by a manifest shallowness in the doer that made it impossible to trace the uncontestable evil of his deeds to any deeper level of roots or motives. The deed was monstrous, but the doer was quite ordinary, commonplace, and neither demonic nor monstrous. The only notable characteristic, she says, that one could detect in his past behavior, as well as in his behavior during the trial, was something entirely negative. That's almost the definition of evil, isn't it? The traditional definition. Almost entirely negative. It was not stupidity, she says, but thoughtlessness. And reflecting on the macabre comedy resulting from Eichmann's helplessness, caught as he was in a cliché-ridden language, he adds, clichés, stock phrases, adherence to conventional, standardized codes of expression and conduct have the socially recognized function of protecting us against reality. That is, lest we exhaust ourselves by the necessity of a constant intellectual engagement of the events and facts always pressing upon us. And this is, in some degree, I'm going to argue against this, but in some degree it's true. Manners are economical in this sense. You see, you save a lot of time in investigation. You can respond to the exterior world through manners without having to justify any response philosophically at every moment. The consequences of such a withdrawal from reality is the disjunction of thought and action, leading to such macabre comedy as that in Eichmann as he stands before the Israeli poet. Who could be more mannerly than J. Alfred Prufrock? The more manners he has, the less able he is to act. That stage spectacle leads Miss Arendt to the questions she is to pursue in her two volumes. And here's, these are her words. Is evil doing, the sins of omission, as well as the sins of commission, possible in default of not just base motives, as the law calls them, but of any motives whatever, of any particular prompting of interest or volition? Is wickedness, however we may define it, this being determined to prove a villain, not a necessary condition for evil doing? Might the problem of good and evil, our faculty for telling right from wrong, be connected with our faculty of thought? If the answer to these questions is yes, as Miss Arendt implies here, then we are left with an enormous problem in attempting to deal with an Eichmann. For we must conclude in this line of thought that he is innocent of wickedness, that his participation in the slaughter of other innocents is an accident of forces which have not yet yielded to the science of thought, an accident of forces loosed by history but not yet subjected to the control of gnosis. Even the ground of our outrage at brutalities is eroded, since outrage is itself presumably susceptible to the control of knowledge. Now, the supposition that wickedness is not necessarily a condition for evil doing is scarcely new. It is a doctrine progressively advanced these past 200 years, till it has in fact become the new orthodoxy. If you don't believe me, read HEW handouts. But tolerance of evil as a social principle, out of philosophical determinism, has had little support in the American South, at least up to the present. Indeed, the fierceness with which the South has resisted such a principle has intensified some judgments of the South as evilly and sinfully inclined in a blatant violation of its own principle on the part of the rabid partisans of that side. The murderer, an old argument said, is no more guilty of his so-called crime than is his knife, an argument still generally rejected as nonsense by most Southerners. What brings Miss Arendt's question into arresting focus, then, is not that it is a new doctrine, but the enormity of its effect upon our world in recent history. You get a muse attention by hitting him with a 2x4. If you kill 100,000 or 2 million people, you can arouse some interest in the sleeping mule, as it were. And what is called into question most particularly is our growing tolerance toward evil, a tolerance established as one of the conditions of millennial progress from the days of Machiavelli into our own recent machinations of human rights as a political instrument in foreign policy. It is one of history's little ironies that we witness a president from the South operating within this new tradition, though professing its opposite. Richard Weaver's warning of the relation between sentimentality and brutality ought to be heeded, particularly by a certain presidential hopeful from Massachusetts. When the Machiavellian figure is discovered operating in the large movements of history, our judgment is tempered by questions of net gain. Evil effects in pursuit of progress are a consequence of high motives. But when a figure who in his effects looms large and Machiavellian is discovered among the ordinary everyday members of humanity rather than in the pantheon of the gods of progress, we are likely to re-examine our intellectual tolerance of evil. An Eichmann, a Jones, a Manson may be sleeping in the room upstairs or sitting down with us at our last supper. We might even encounter him on a deserted dirt road in Georgia, as Flannery O'Connor's grandmother does in her story, A Good Man is Hard to Find. The argument that wickedness is not the necessary ground in the individual out of which evil deeds grows is a line of thought which has, of course, been overwhelmingly advanced by those new sciences, sociology and its handmade psychology. The arguments of those disciplines have generally narrowed the possibilities of individual freedom and responsibility, and until, in the cliche language of Miss O'Connor's Reba Tarwater, such a creature as Eichmann must be logically excused on the ground that he is somehow, quote, an accident of nature, no less than is Reba's own idiot child. If action is forced upon society by the enormity of an evil deed, it must be considered a corrective of nature, execution or incarceration thus being reduced from any relation to retribution. For neither anger nor love may find any rational role in such actions. Reba Tarwater, in spite of himself, is so moved by love for his idiot son that he cannot kill the child. But he can understand that love only as an aberration, an encroaching insanity. Recently, Walter Burns in Harper's has urged us to consider that anger directed against those who commit evil deeds at least, quote, acknowledges the humanity of its objects. It holds them accountable for what they do. And in holding particular men responsible, it pays them the respect that is due them as men. The failure of his fellows to hold that degree of respect for him, who choose rather to explain him away as a mechanistic creature of nature, is the maddening pain in Miss O'Connor's misfit. We would have touched on this a little bit last night. I think Madison doesn't go all the way with you here. The grandmother tries to save herself by saying all of the social cliches. You had a bad family background. The newspapers did it to you, you see. If you just go see a counselor, all will be well. And of course, the misfit rejects every one of those arguments that she tries to advance to explain to you. Good having been explained away, he has only his evil to give him any sense of being at all. Ironically, he's a better Christian than many a man who professes the faith, since his sense of loss is a sense of having lost the good, at least. It would not be difficult to persuade him of the reality of original sin. That's why Miss O'Connor says that he was meant to be a prophet, I think, and might yet be. Burns put, you know how it is to be born again. Burns puts the conclusion to be drawn from our exorcised anger. If then men are not angry when somebody else is robbed, raped, or murdered, the implication is that no moral community exists because those men do not care for anyone other than themselves. It is a conclusion the misfit feels forced to. He says, it's nothing for you to do but enjoy the few minutes you got left the best way you can, by killing somebody or burning down his house or doing some other meanness to him. But the gnawing thing in him is that even then, as he says, it's no pleasure in life. One is struck on reading Miss Aaron's characterization of Eichmann by its aptness to Miss O'Connor's misfit. Is it that lady? I am concluding by talking about the attraction to mystery in nature that this southern writer feels, and it involves the mystery of evil itself, and the concern for violence, the distortions of reality, is not simply a concern for the accidents of nature. Accident is something larger than we choose to call it. The mysterious attraction in evil is a principle our Southern writer has rather constantly in mind as he bears witness by art to a multitudinous existence, one aspect of which is the constant struggle the soul endures in the in-between. And he knows that a part of his own struggle lies in the art with which he bears his witness. We encounter a number of kinsmen to Miss O'Connor's misfit, characters who fight desperately to establish at least their claim to evil against social and psychological and philosophical attempts to absolve them of that birthright. They reveal themselves in grotesque distortions that mix terror and comedy in our art. If we find them conspicuously revealed in Southern literature, we should know as well that we will find them wherever two or three are gathered together. That is the point at which the storytelling begins, a place in history as reflected in the little world of particular persons and their things. Thank you.